You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
German concerns about Russian election influence mount. In the U.S., the NSA director says a nation-state made a conscious attempt to influence American elections. Dictators can use social media too, it seems. Holiday shopping security warnings are out, and they're not just about online purchases either. The U.K.'s snooper charter passes the House of Lords, and a Russian court tells that country's ISPs to shut down LinkedIn. It's a concern about privacy, don't you know? I'm Dave Bittner in Baltimore with your CyberWire summary for Thursday, November 17, 2016. Hans-Georg Maaßen, head of Germany's Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, adds his voice to warnings of potential Russian interference in German elections. Maaßen told Reuters he thinks the Russian objective would be to erode confidence in German institutions and to sow mistrust among members of the European Union. The information operations he describes would count as black propaganda, that is, as false stories, the counter to which he says should be unmasking and rumor control. Foreign Policy makes a depressing observation about cyberspace, both in terms of security and in terms of information operations. Repressive regimes have found many ways of turning social media to unfortunate advantage. Twitter's rise as the day star in the false dawn of Iran's Green Revolution now seems like ancient history. Information may want to be free, sure, but a kind of Gresham's Law might also be operating here, with bad money driving good money out of the marketplace. So German concerns track U.S. concerns on this matter fairly closely. NSA Director Admiral Michael Rogers said this week that an unnamed state, but there's no mystery about which one, the U.S. intelligence community named Russia a few weeks ago, made a conscious effort to affect the recent U.S. elections via WikiLeaks. The WikiLeaks connection is significant, since it would make the operation Julian Assange leads to be, in U.S. official eyes, at the very least, an agent of influence acting on behalf of Russian interests. It's worth noting that whatever motives WikiLeaks has are likely to be overdetermined. Assange probably had political rooting interests and taste for online muckraking long before any alleged contact by Russian organs. Reactions in the U.S. press are interesting. Mother Jones wants Congress to investigate, and Mother Jones is sounding, perhaps surprisingly, a lot more like Mr. Deeds than their labor activist and Wobbly founder namesake. An op-ed in the Christian Science Monitor's Passcode, remembering that the documents leaked were apparently genuine enough, argues that the big lesson to take away from the U.S. elections is that everyone, especially politicians and their staffs and their enablers, needs to do a better job of securing themselves online. An ongoing threat to organizations and individuals alike are phishing attacks, typically emails that use social engineering to get users to click through to nefarious websites or otherwise unwittingly do the bidding of the baddies. We checked in with John LaCour, CEO of Fish Labs, for some advice on fighting the phishers.
Security hardware and software companies try to make technology that catches the attacks before they get put in front of humans. And by and large, they work pretty well. Most of the bad stuff is filtered out. But yet some of it still gets through. And, you know, the bad guys are able to tailor their emails and tweak them over time to figure out how to make them get through. So some of these malicious messages end up in user mailboxes, you know, where users have to take action to either infect their computer, open the back door for the bad guys. You know, automated technology is not going to be a panacea, but it does help.
Do people's perceptions of phishing align with the reality of it? Do people consider it to be the serious threat that it is? Do they take it more seriously than they should, or less seriously than they should, or somewhere in the middle?
I think people don't take it seriously enough. I think it's one of those things where you know, they hear about the media stories of data breaches, but most people think, well, that's happens to other people, or I'm going to recognize the attacks. But the reality is that, you know, and it's a good thing in a way, most people's human nature is to be helpful. And so the attackers know this and use that as part of their attack. So they'll send email messages that are friendly. In some cases, the attackers will send emails that are very demanding and ominous, and they want to encourage people to take action right away. And so I think people don't understand how sophisticated some of these attacks can be, and generally are not very good at spotting the phishing messages. You know, we've known about phishing for a long time, and companies are still losing, in some cases, millions of dollars every year to phishing attacks. So, you know, the results speak for themselves. Phishing is still a big problem.
So what's your advice to companies who want to try to get a better handle on this?
Yeah, so my advice to companies is to really do three things. It's a three-pronged approach. The first is to educate your users, and that's your first line of defense after the security technologies that you've already invested in. The second step is, once you've educated users, leverage them as part of your threat detection system, if you will. Have a process whereby users can report suspicious emails and have them acted upon. And then thirdly, take those learnings from those reports and use that as a feedback loop to better your security posture, whether that's by improving technology and tools that you've purchased, whether that's by improving your education program, or just better information about what sort of information or data your attackers are going after.
That's John LaCour from Phish Labs. Huawei and ZTE scrambled to reassure customers about the EdUps backdoor crypto wire researchers found in too many phones. Huawei asserts firmly that it's never been a customer of the Shanghai EdUps technology company. ZTE doesn't go quite that far, but it does say that none of the phones it sold in the U.S. feature the backdoor. Enigma Software predicts a holiday cybercrime spike, and others, including Core Security and SkyCure, offer advice on staying safe while shopping. SkyCure's even got a rundown on the riskiest mall Wi-Fi systems. You can read the whole thing from the link in today's CyberWire Daily News Brief, but we'll just say that there's one shopping center in Vegas where you should probably keep your phone turned off. Recorded Future is offering a peek into the mind of the cybercriminal. Readers of Freakonomics, who've seen how low-level street criminals are recruited even though the money goes to the kingpins, and those of you who saw Donnie Brasco and remember the Pacino character trying to saw open parking meters for chump change, won't be surprised to learn that low-level cyberhoods lack skills and really just don't make very much. But alas, they're still out there, so be on guard when you shop during the holidays. Others are predicting a holiday surge of denial of service, too, in part because the barriers of entry in this part of the criminal market have dropped as much as they have. The CyberWire heard from Plixer's CEO Michael Patterson on this issue. He said, quote, "It's no surprise that the volume of DDoS attacks are on the rise. It provides value to cybercriminals in multiple ways," end quote. It can, as we've seen, serve as a misdirection for a simultaneous targeted attack. And the threat of DDoS can be a way of extorting companies, like retailers depending on holiday online sales, to pay up or face seasonal ruin. Patterson went on to say that the widespread availability of Mirai source code has contributed to the problem, as has the proliferation of connected things in the Internet of Things. Quote, "If you consider that Gartner estimates that by 2020, 50 billion connected things will be on the Internet, you can appreciate that the trend here isn't really our friend," end quote. In the UK, the Snoopers Charter passes the Lords. This means that once it receives the expected essentially routine royal assent, it will become law, probably before the new year. And finally, because the Russian government cares as much about personal privacy as it does about combinations in restraint of trade, a Russian court has ruled that the country's ISPs must block LinkedIn. You did see that Kaspersky and Microsoft are now in an antitrust dust-up in a Moscow court?
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire.
Joining me once again is Ron Yehalem. He's the project leader at the Malware Lab of the Cybersecurity Research Center at Ben-Gurion University. Ron, USB devices are one of your specialties, and today you wanted to take us through some potential hardware vulnerabilities when it comes to USB devices.
I want to talk about two categories, primary categories of USB hardware attacks. The first one is what I call Trojan attacks. Now, there are many inexpensive microcontrollers out there that can be used to emulate different USB devices, practically any USB device, while being concealed in an innocuous casing. For example, you can consider the TNC, which is a complete USB microcontroller development system and comes with many free software development tools and can be purchased for only $20. And another example is the universal RF USB keyboard emulation device, which was developed by Monta Elkins, which is basically a TNC with an additional radio frequency component attached to it. And it allows the adaptive and remote delivery of keystrokes to a computer. So it's actually overcoming the blind timing and selection of attacks. And these are challenges that you it's impossible to overcome if you can't operate from a remote location. And a different example is the USB rubber ducky, which is a commercial keystroke injection attack platform. It's based on an Amtel microcontroller that poses as a keyboard. And it's developed by the nice folk at Hack5. It can be purchased for about $45. It's a little bit more expensive, but it's it does almost everything with a very simple language that you can code the scripts with. And it will automatically execute a script of commands. It's capable of changing system settings, opening back doors, retrieving data, initiating reverse shells, or basically anything that you can achieve with physical access. And it does that all in a matter of seconds. So the second category, I guess you can call them electrical attacks. This thing was originally referred to as a USB killer, and it was developed by a Russian security researcher in 2015, nicknamed Dark Purple. And what he did, he just built a USB stick that's capable of destroying sensitive components of your computer once it's plugged in. Okay, basically what he does is once you connect the stick to a host's USB port, it starts the operation of a voltage converter on the USB stick, which charges a capacitor to about minus 220 volts. And then when that voltage is achieved, the converter is switched off, the capacitor is discharged, and its accumulated energy is just supplied to the signal lines of the USB interface. And this cycle is repeated, and about a couple of seconds, you can incapacitate the host computer. So it basically fries part of the computer. So what we really should hope for are new USB devices that the manufacturers do add some kind of hardware signature validation of the firmware. Another approach maybe would be to develop all sorts of detection methods, kind of like what my research is aiming at, so that we can continue using the very many currently available USB devices, but be safe.
All right, Ron Yehalem, thanks for joining us. And that's the CyberWire. We are proudly produced in Maryland by our talented team of editors and producers. I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening.